a burdock clawed my gown. Not burdock's blame, but mine. Who went too near the burdock's den? A bog affronts my shoe. What else have bogs to do? The only trade they know, the splashing men. Ah, pity then, 'tis minnows can despise the elephant's calm eyes. Look further on.
This is The Slave Is Gone, the show that talks back to Apple TV's Dickinson.
I'm Jericho Brown.
And I'm Brianne Janae, but you can call me Breezy.
We explore what's historically true, what's emotionally true, what works for us,
and what doesn't, in the Apple TV series about Emily Dickinson.
And because we're poets who are fascinated by Dickinson's verse, we always bring it back to the poetry. Hey, Breezy.
Hey, Jericho.
We are back again to talk about an episode of Dickinson, what it says about her world and ours.
We'll be joined by a guest poet who loves Emily Dickinson and who also happens to be a fan of this series, the one and only Evie Shockley.
And we'll be calling on our rogue scholar, Aoife Murray, to sort through what's reality and fiction.
But first, let's recap it. Dickinson, Season 1, Episode 7, We Lose Because We Win.
The circus comes to Amherst, and Emily and her sister Lavinia want to go, but their father Edward says no.
Edward Dickinson has a lot on his mind. He's running for re-election to Congress, and it's election day. He's surprised to be in a close race with a candidate from the anti-immigrant Know Nothing Party.
Edward finds their Irish maid, Maggie, crying because her brothers got beaten up for voting, and he vows to stop things like that from happening.
But when asked if he'd abolish slavery, Edward says he has a headache.
Meanwhile, Emily's been urged by Ben, her father's clerk, who she's in love with, to enter a local poetry contest, but she refuses, knowing it would infuriate her father. Instead, she has her brother Austin submit her poem, Nobody Knows This Little Rose, under his name.
That night, Emily's sister Lavinia hosts a slumber party where she and her friends discuss who they'd vote for, if they could vote. Emily says she knows death, and he's told her a civil war is coming.
The next morning, at the breakfast table, Austin announces that he'll move the grave of a baby so his fiancée Sue can be buried next to him when they die. And in the newspaper, the family learns that Austin's poem has won the contest.
Emily's father, Edward, realizes the poem is hers, of course, enters her room without knocking, and slaps her hard. Maggie overhears.
Edward wins his election. Maggie comments with sarcasm that it's a relief that the men of honor and decency have prevailed.
Well, Jericho?
Hi, Breezy.
It's election day in the Dickinson household.
Wow.
And her father is being obnoxious, yeah, as usual.
Yeah.
Pestering Ben about who he's going to vote for.
That's strange.
Voting the party line. And I did respect Ben saying he was independent. He likes to think it through.
It's so funny that that's what being independent means.
Mm. Do you want
that's
to say more?
Well, we'll talk. We'll talk. Before we talk, we should probably bring on our very special guest, the poet and scholar, Evie Shockley, who's here with us today.
Evie is the Zora Neale Hurston Distinguished Professor of English at Rutgers. Her most recent collection of poems, Semi-Automatic, won the Hurston Wright Award and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize.
Her new collection of poems, Suddenly We, will be out from Wesleyan University Press in March.
It is so great to have you on The Slave Is Gone today.
And big congrats on the new book coming out. That's exciting.
Oh, it's exciting. It feels like a long time coming, but.
Yeah, it's really great. Dickens's poems have now allowed for this television show. And one of the subjects of this show is abolition.
Right.
Which Emily's father wants to talk a lot in this episode, but he does not want to talk about abolition.
No, he does not.
My head.
Not at all. He's so ready to be Maggie's savior, but like won't even cough.
Yeah.
His daughter abolition. Had to jump in and try to save him, but that's okay. Lavinia's always jumping in.
The show opens with a sign saying, you know, that the election is coming up and it's time to vote. But then that sign immediately gets covered up by a sign that the circus is coming, which I think is
a very apt metaphor.
Really perfect for contemporary politics. And then we later see that Emily Dickinson's father is indeed nervous about the election because it seems that he's not a shoo-in.
And it's interesting how they sort of frame or talk about the politics of the time period. You know, one of the reasons he's not a shoo-in is because the know-nothings are like shoring up support and doing all of this stuff. And it was interesting to hear them talk about it in sort of foil for modern politics and like what they were willing to say and what they weren't.
I love that aspect of the show. It's doing this thing where maybe we're going to bring some 19th century stuff in here for you. I mean, the know-nothings were a real thing, but.
Really?
Weren't they?
Aoife, will you tell us, were the know-nothings a real thing?
They were. Absolutely.
That's absurd.
And they sort of.
Too damn on the nose. I'm sorry.
The wigs were going down. And the know-nothings were, just like it says in the show, and they were filling this gap. They were anti-Catholic. And it just so happens that Germans were coming into the country, Irish people were coming into the country. They happened to be a Catholic. And the Whigs were all over the map. I mean, you have Northern Virginia enslavers who were Whigs. And then you have people in Massachusetts who, both sides of the fence.
It seems like slavery in particular for the Whig Party was not a concern. By that, what I mean is some Whigs were for it, some Whigs are against it. It's not one of their main points, although it's becoming a main point of the moment because there's about to be a war, which we also find out in this episode. We've been sort of told about this war from death, from the visual representation of death throughout the season. And the war is finally getting announced to us at the same time that these election results are getting announced, which also seemed like.
The enslavers secretly controlled DC. There's militants rising in New England who wanna send pioneers with guns and gear to settle Kansas. I mean, it's like politics are becoming militarized. Sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what I love about this issue, is that they're using these 19th century sort of touchstones, but the language is all coded for us to understand ourselves through it. It's like science fiction in reverse.
Which is why the know-nothings seemed so absurd that it couldn't be real. And it like reminds me of, like it felt like satire of, there's some Republican person who's like constantly referring to Republicans, like we the sweaty Walmart people.
It's the moment where like 200 years from now, someone says, wait, they had a tea party? And you'll be like,
yeah.
It is indeed really fractious, but Edward does win that seat, as the show says. He does win a congressional seat in 1852, but it's really fractious. There's even talk of voter fraud in Kansas. Now, and that period is probably two of the most tumultuous periods. It's even getting super violent.
Yeah, that is scary, that comparison. as soon as you said it and it was violent, I was like, oh, it's violent now.
They keep those points of comparison running through the show. I mean, there is nothing more delightful than hearing Lavinia say, of course, if you're anti-slavery, you have to vote Republican. Mm-hmm, it's just like, come with it. I want all that irony. Mm-hmm. I love it.
But there's also something going on that's very different from the political scene, at least in Emily Dickinson's mind. She's written a poem that she wants to enter into a contest with the encouragement of her man, honey, which makes me so glad. That's what I want a man to tell me. You should enter a poem into a contest. Wow. Baby, ain't that sweet? Wow. In spite of the fact that he knows, I mean, he knows you could not do it, but then you'll regret not doing it.
But would you enter a poem under a sibling's name? Like, if that was your choice, if your choice was no publication or a sibling, I don't know.
I feel no. Maybe as anonymous.
So they can't have a poem.
Right. And give a title to it.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's if murder. I don't know if anonymous could enter the contest, though.
I mean, probably not. Although it seems like those were the days when anonymous was everywhere.
Yeah. Anonymous really was writing some poems now. Anonymous is wearing it out. Yes, I think this is a great question because I wonder, I think if it were my sister, I would. But then I can think of other people's sisters and brothers where I'd be like, no.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's because we see such rivalry between them already. The fact that they have the same, they're in this love triangle with Sue. They're kind of vying for their father's affection. It's messy. You can't, you can say that you're not going to be mad, but you know you're going to be mad. She knew she was going to be mad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he changed the title. I mean, he gave the poem a title and nobody asked him to do that.
That's true. She did seem okay until she heard that. And then
she was very excited.
Her whole body rebelled.
And dedicated to her boo too, which is his boo, but like, it's just insult to injury. Which, like, speaking of Austin and Sue, their little arc in the story is him buying this, or him moving this dead baby for her. And I don't know, it's interesting to watch the ways the show is treating death throughout this episode and throughout the show in general, but it's just like comedy, Sue, tragedy, you know. It's like the scene with her baking with the mother, and she's like, well, I know because I was an orphan. And then that it's just like, true. There's the other moment where like death reappears with the Civil War coming up.
Right.
And that part is ominous and serious.
A real downer at the party, right?
Mm-hmm. 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 But moving that baby and like her and Austin sitting there watching it together. It's like, is that really romantic?
Oh my God.
Possessive, my dude. Like,
with the arm around her shoulder. Like,
yeah. It's like, you don't love me until you end the ground.
I can't get with him, except when he's playing, you know, Desdemona or something else.
Yeah.
Well, it also, it seems that Sue is aware of her lot in life in a way that Emily and other characters in the show do not understand their positions. And Sue is very aware, which is why she gets so mad at Emily. Emily's mother gives her a book, which I think is about being a housewife, I imagine. And then Emily's like, oh, you're taking this housewife thing seriously. I didn't think she was. Sue told her to eat shit. Did she tell her to eat shit?
She did. She definitely did.
I was like, Sue does not want to get married.
Right? Sue is just out here trying to survive in these streets. Gonna have some skills. And Emily is taunting her for it.
You know, I found myself thinking about just now when you were saying that Sue's the space of tragedy and death in this episode. I'm thinking back, sorry to be all like fangirling on the podcast, but I'm thinking back to the earlier episode where you all talked about the episode couldn't just focus on the fugitive slave issue. We also had to have Sue. And I totally get what you all were arguing, but there's this way that I feel like Sue's character just becomes really interesting as this, the foil for the privilege that people can see in a way that they're not gonna see the Black characters as foils for the privilege.
Mm-hmm.
For all the reasons that people don't see Black people in three dimensions in the first place. Mm-hmm.
Mm. While Emily is enjoying her privilege as a single person and who seems to not be, she's not at this point in the show being forced to marry anybody. I mean, there's a point earlier in the season where it seems like they're interested in that. And it's almost like they've just given up. You know what I mean? And while she's enjoying that privilege, she's not understanding that she's enjoying that privilege in somebody in front of a person who doesn't have the same option that she does.
Yeah. I mean, we also kind of see that she hasn't let it sink in that she's enjoying that privilege of not being married off, but it means that she's still basically, I mean, not married to her father, but you know.
But more or less.
I mean, she's still his property if she's not going to become somebody else's, I'll say possession, maybe.
We do really feel that tension in this episode. Because while we can say that Emily is privileged to have her father, you know, as this like person who can provide and get her a maid when she says, I want a maid, he's also violent, you know. There's also the danger of trying to like, you have to keep this provider person happy.
Happy. Mm-hmm. Man, I mean, that
he
moment.
Might slap you. Mm-hmm. What did you think about that, Evie?
That really, I feel like it hit me in the way it hit Emily. It was like, no pun intended. He's a tyrant. He's been a tyrant, but he hasn't been physically violent, if I'm remembering correctly, in the show. Mm-hmm. And so it might have been less surprising if he had hit the maid, although I think he wouldn't do that because that would cross a line in a social sense. When he said, I don't have to knock, I was like, oh, we know this.
Yeah. Yeah. He's also such a baby this episode. Like his wife is literally on her knees, rubbing his feet. The girls who are up, you know, barely making a peep are too loud.
He set up such an impossible situation by not wanting her to leave, but then setting up poetry as a freak activity or its freakish behavior. It disrupts class, it disrupts gender norms. So they're like opposite poles. They can never be free of each other almost. But what's interesting is the idea of female greatness is not, you cannot put those two words together in that family. But also more disturbing is he defended a wife beater as a lawyer.
He defends in real life.
Yes, in real life, he defends a wife beater. And the wife is actually one of Emily's former teachers. So you can imagine the intensity with which she followed the case.
What?
And his defense of the wife beater, he uses an insanity, like the wife is insane. So he brings people into the stand, but it's just interesting to think about that case in the light of the slap.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been annoying the entire season, but in this moment when he wants to really get elected, he can't believe he's going to lose. And then all of that frustration results in him hitting his daughter. This moment sort of names that in a way that it was sort of always there, but now it's no longer subtle. Maybe Aoife can talk about the accuracy with which they handle just how upset he is. I mean, this is the second time that he's like really angry that his daughter's writing poetry. If you don't want your daughter writing poetry, then maybe you don't care about who her teacher was, right? Yeah. Or maybe you even have some sort of animosity toward her teacher already, because maybe you think of that as the person who, you know, taught her to read and write.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? Is Emily Dickinson's real life father so anti-poetry?
She does tell her, I guess you could say, mentor, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, my father buys me books, but then begs me not to read them. So that's kind of this classic thing. And she shares her poems with like 100 people. I mean, there's so many people that know she's a poet. Mm-hmm. So does her father know she's a poet? How could you mm-hmm. not? Mm-hmm. I mean, you'd be blind to not know what drives the children in your house. Or
I really want you to help me remember what I read a long time ago about this. Was he the reason that she didn't publish more, or was she herself more reticent about publication? You know, I feel like if it's the latter, it's fine to me that the show takes that liberty and, you know, portrays her as somebody who really wanted to be known. But
I think the show is, it's television, so the show is really amping some things up. Dickinson published about 10 poems of her poems in a circulating journal or book. Mask of Poets was one of them. I think every one of them, maybe one might have had her name, but they were mostly anonymous. Is the father the driver of that? That's a really interesting question. I don't think he is, but then one might think that there's a certain kind of propriety, like what can Dickinsons do and what can't they do? Because they're like...
aristocracy.
They're aristocracy for Amherst, the region. I mean, he's a congressman, and so what can a daughter do in a circumstance like that? What is okay to do?
There's always the unspoken rules in a family, you know.
Right. And what she can get away with in the town. But then there's also, if you think about, I mean, she was corresponding with a lot of people, and those people all got poems. So...
did we get into that slumber party, which was such a delightful contrast to sort of the expectation of what we think a slumber party is supposed to be versus what they gave us? Love that moment of like, Jane, you're just like so woke, you know?
Oh my God. Yeah, I mean, the level of knowledge that they had while the father's downstairs saying, oh, these girls up there chattering and whatever. And they're like, they're the ones who are thinking about the national issues. Mm-hmm. I love it. I'm here for all irony, always.
Aoife, did you have anything to share with us about that, what they were talking about?
I do. I think it's, I loved where they went and where they didn't go. Because someone, and we don't really see who's saying it, someone says, hey, do you think the South is going to secede? And then Lavinia goes, oh, it would be economically devastating for everyone. It's so interesting to be talking about Kansas, Nebraska, but look at those girls in those cotton PJs. And I thought, hey, these girls are complicit. So not only are those girls complicit, my God, the Dickinsons, Lavinia asks the question, oh, it would be devastating for everybody. Mm-hmm. Hey, it would be really devastating for those Dickinsons. The Amherst economy, the economy of the little town that her mother's from. I mean, we could go to talking about her two uncles who are, and cousin, who are enslavers in the South. But I'm really talking about her maternal side and her paternal side getting rich, mm-hmm. and how the North is this industrial engine, mm-hmm. and the raw product coming up from the South, the cotton coming up, is driving that engine. Even decades before Emily Dickinson is born, and this is why she's born into such a wealthy family, her great uncle opens a cotton mill. Her grandfather is involved with several cotton mills. And this is a town that's like 25 miles south. So there's an enslaver, Israel Trask. He's contemporary with Emily Dickinson's grandfather, Joel Norcross, and they grow up in the same town together. So they're not just buying cotton materials from the South, from some anonymous suppliers. These are close relationships, business and personal, between Emily Dickinson's family and enslavers. Israel Trask, on the advice of Alexander Hamilton, yes, that Hamilton, says, I think you should go south. Gets married almost as soon as he gets down there. And part of his wife's dowry is a plantation in Mississippi.
Wow.
Trask turns the operation of his Mississippi plantations over to his brother. He returns to Massachusetts and acts basically as a business agent, developing business back and forth between Mississippi and Massachusetts. He starts a cotton and wool mill with a group of partners, which in a few years ends up getting merged with the Union Cotton Factory Company, which was owned by Joel Norcross, Emily's maternal grandfather. It's hard to prove definitively that the cotton used in those mills came directly from Israel Trask's plantations in Mississippi. But there's ongoing correspondence between Trask and his brother about shipments of cotton to Boston. So it's hard to imagine that cotton doesn't end up in the mills Emily's grandfather grows rich from. So when Lavinia says to Jane, "Oh, Jane, you are so woke," and I'm thinking, okay, we're doing some woke washing here, because, and they're talking about faraway places, Kansas and Nebraska, but these girls know. I mean, they're sitting comfortably with this contradiction. I want to give credit to Anna Smith, who is a researcher for our podcast, for digging in the archives and revealing these close connections between the generational wealth of the Dickinsons and enslavement. Anna points out how that wealth helped create the circumstances for Emily Dickinson being able to become a poet. Without that enormous wealth, would she even have had her large bedroom to write in? Would she have been forced to find a job or a husband? She would have been a completely different person.
Well, I feel this sort of brings us to the case that always needs to be made for reparations. because I feel like I have yet to meet a white person that wasn't a stone's throw from slave money somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Because you're in the United States.
Yeah.
Because you're in the United States. And, you know, I have to say, I appreciate Aoife rehearsing all of that, because here I am, my bar is so low for television. I'm like, Lavinia said economically slavery was good for everybody. And I'm like, woo, yay. She said that out loud. And Aoife was like, they could have talked about this, 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 and this. They could have really, you know, shown all the ways that all of these things are connected and all the reasons why it took until 1865 or 1861 for the North to muster some will behind its great moral conscience, right? You know.
It's also interesting that they're very aware of the fact that as women, they can't vote, but not aware of the fact, it seems, that all of those Black people in the South also cannot vote, have no say in their own future. Also, there's this awareness that if they did have say, they wouldn't want to be slaves. That's so interesting to me, you know? There's this question about, you know, right and wrong here, and should there be slavery or not? But it's also like, well, who are the slaves and what would they want? You know what I'm saying?
Let's get some self-determination in here.
And in the contemporary moment, we're still finding ways for people not to be able to vote. And I know that I am of, and people a little younger than me are of, a generation of people who sort of, you know, they're not interested in voting at all. They're not even interested in the conversation about voting, because nothing seems to ever work. You know, you still see the same things going on in the 1850s and 60s. And so you're like, why am I doing that? Oh, and that brings me to a question I had, Aoife, about Maggie and her brothers. Part of this episode relies on the know-nothings beating Maggie's brothers up at the poll. But in reality, would they have been able to vote? Who can and cannot vote?
Well, that's so interesting, because particularly in Massachusetts, Black and Indigenous men technically could vote. There were no protections from, in case people were discriminated against in the voting process. So there's no protection. But in sort of the early part of the 19th century, so I'm saying like 1800, 1830, there are some constitutional revisions, which is interesting because this is when emancipation happens in the North, right? So New England, in 1790 census, Massachusetts census, there are no longer slaves appearing on the census in Massachusetts. But in 1800 to 1830, there starts to be some state constitutional revisions that change voters from inhabitant to you need to be a citizen. And citizenship, then in 1857, there starts to be a reading requirement. So that X's out a lot of people. Then in 1859, there starts to be a 2-year waiting period. So that would affect her brothers because this is about the naturalization process. So there was a 2-year waiting period. So they grandfathered in people who'd been here a really long time. So let's say, you know, you're 60 or 50 or something, maybe you'd be grandfathered in, but younger people wouldn't. So disenfranchising or trying to play with and using the legal system to take rights away or deny rights or just make it difficult begins in the 19th century.
It's interesting that they use Maggie and her brothers as the foil or the way to talk about voter suppression, right? As opposed to the Black people in the House, right? If Black people could have technically voted, then they could have used Henry as the character to drive that narrative. But it's, once again, you know, the white Irish maid that is sort of making these issues perhaps more palatable.
Palatable. Yeah. You know, I think about that so much, whether this is a concession to the idea that if we do it with Black people, it will just feel normal. Are they failing to trust the audience enough to get the same sense of injustice if it was Henry who wasn't able to vote?
Yeah, but they don't.
They don't.
I don't know. I don't know that they should. I mean, you know, when I do think, I don't know because I'm not white, but I do think that when that when white people see things happen to Black people on television, nothing happened in their minds. When they see things happen to white people on TV, they understand, oh, that's why that can't happen to Black people. And I also think that our education is built around that. The possibilities of what can befall white people are the reasons why freedoms for everybody exist. Do you know what I mean? Which is really interesting and strange, but true.
Thanks to Smith College for its sponsorship of The Slave is Gone.
Smith first opened its doors to students in 1871 when Emily Dickinson was still living and writing up the road in Amherst.
And just like no one at that time would have imagined that Emily Dickinson's poems would be read around the world, they'd probably also be surprised by the impact this women's college continues to have more than 150 years later.
Smith's faculty, students, and community of alums are driving change in the world, making knowledge a force for good.
Whether you're a parent, a prospective student, an academic professional, or someone who counts yourself as part of the Smith community, learn about Smith now at smith.edu.
I just want to say this about Maggie. She knows that Emily Dickinson's father has slapped Emily Dickinson.
That moment.
And she knows that she cannot shame him about that. And so what she does, as so many domestic workers have, is she makes use of sarcasm, which if you recognize the sarcasm, you have to also admit that you were wrong. And so they had sarcasm on their side. They have sarcasm on their side because you can't recognize it. You have to act like what is meant is true. And she uses her position, what position she has, to let him know that you getting elected is not as important as your relationship with your daughter. And Evie, you had another poem that you said was much more a father-daughter poem. And I was hoping that Maggie could get us there too. And I really, you know, I just want you to read your whole book.
Bring us around.
You know, if you just want to if you just want to read the whole book to us, I got time. I don't know about everybody else out here, but I got a feeling we don't mind it. You know, this is still a poetry show.
Stop, Jericho. You just make me feel good. We should all be three and be trading poems for an hour and a half and call it a night and then just go watch another episode of Dickinson.
Right. But
yeah, that moment was so powerful that when she, you know, she's like, "God, the men of decency have won, have they?" Okay. Mm-hmm. And you know, and as you say, it just blew over his head. Like many, many a daughter, I have had my rough and rocky aspects of my relationship with my father. And I have to say, before I read this, that I read it one time in front of Sonia Sanchez, and she said, "That's still your father." And I thought I was going to get that sympathetic ear of woman who, you know, had written some poems about her father when she was younger, too. But this was the post, "Does your house have lions?" Sonia Sanchez. So I just want to acknowledge that there are many aspects to my father, and this is not meant to sort of represent everything he is, but this is called Daddy's Girl. "You call, I take your raspy, hey baby, like a vaccine. Your approach is backdoor, attuned to years of piss poor welcome. We are both helpless in the groove. You mirror me my splotchy humanity when I'm going for goddess, demanding worship from the apogee like a nappy-headed Diana. Back off. Come back. When I was 4, I planned to marry you with bright penny certainty. Who else? Told mommy so. Freud kissed my ass. Of course, you pick Pestalozzi, some Swiss guy with ideas about kindergarten, for your philosopher hero. Your students, brown-faced September daisies, sprout annually for 13 years, always freshly 5 and asking for nothing more than an alphabet. But daughters are perennial. Like trees, we grow up and up, thicken, spread out. Sure, we shed our trimmings, start again, but never from scratch. At 26, I write myself madly out of your grasp, running smack into a Ted Hughes of my own. At the wedding, I am white and stiff as a taper. You are smiling like a convict. I take the petal-strewn paper carpet stroll alone like a good feminist. Your face is joy in watercolors, right on the verge of becoming something else. Damn it, the one time it isn't personal, you get hurt. I register the frost in your mustache, the blizzard blotting your mental landmarks, and growl. April is cruel, but December's only humoring us. I am the sun, caged in a Ptolemaic nightmare. No, I am Galileo facing a ritual inquisition. Be a sweet girl for daddy, okay? I spit out heliocentric heresies. I am 33 and my moves are measured in galaxies, not days. Now what? You gonna cut out my tongue, wash my fucking mouth out with soap? Don't talk that way to me. I'm still your father. I grip the receiver like a steering wheel, rub my red eyes, squint into the distance lowered between us like a shade. If you were the vast Pacific and I pushed from a raft, just cresting the navel of your muddy belly, I still couldn't fall into your arms."
Oh, wow. Oh, come on. Let's go. Let's write poems. Yes.
Let's write some poems.
Read poems to us. Yes. I love that.
That's you a know, very old
she's
poem.
Using, she's using literally a phrase. Sonia Sanchez is using literally a phrase from the poem. She's letting you know she heard the poem. And she, let me tell you why she really heard that poem. It's such a poet's poem. I mean, you don't have to be a poet, obviously, to hear what's going on. But the references, I mean, there are things that she hears that she knows everybody else can't hear. And and that she probably hears better than us because of her own education. I was talking with a friend of mine about this, right? You know, like saying April is the cruelest month. You know, if over a certain age, everybody knows exactly where that's from. But under a certain age, you don't have to know that anymore. Do you know what I mean? It's really interesting.
Right.
That's beautiful, Evie. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I saw it the first time I saw Sandy Sanchez read, she read a poem that was not so nice, I guess, for lack of a better word, for her father. Then after she read the poem, she said, I know that was a hard poem. It was very interesting. Like she wanted to let us know that it was a poem, that it wasn't her dad. You know?
That.
She's like, I know that was a hard poem. So we usually conclude our show with a question for the poets from our rogue scholar. What is our question for the poets today?
Can I respond to Evie's poem for a minute?
Please.
Because we've been talking about this conflict between, in the show, between Dickinson and her father. And as I listened to you read that poem, I said, oh, he's jealous of her poetry because there's something that she loves more than him.
That feels like a real insight. Yeah, I think you're right.
How has Dickinson's work manifest in your own?
I'm going to go first because I just have an instantaneous answer to this. I do think we sort of started the show talking about this. When I was first reading Dickinson, I must have been 9 or 10 years old. And I really did think the dashes were openings. I thought they were somehow blanks. I mean, I know they weren't blanks, they were dashes, but they felt like something, it felt like I was supposed to fill something in. Where that dash was, I think this is really part of why I fell in love with poetry, because I understood that it was indeed interactive. And what I love about what we think of as I guess high art, or fine art, I'd rather say fine art, what we think about as fine art, that, you know, the difference between Barry Jenkins in Tyler Perry is when you're watching a Tyler Perry film, it all just happens to you and you laugh. But when you're watching Moonlight, you have to participate.
Yes.
And every time you see it, you have more, you don't have less participation to do. You have, every time I read a poem I love, I have no choice but to love it more. The more I read it, you know, I have more work to do. I have to participate. And I think Dickinson, we said this at the beginning, it always felt like there was something unsaid. And what was unsaid was what I got to say. And I think when I'm writing my poems, they don't look like, my poems don't look like Emily Dickinson's poems, but I'm writing toward allowing who I imagine. And when I say who I imagine, I don't mean a particular reader, but I mean that I think every poem calls out to an audience and you don't get to know who that audience is, thank God. And that part of the calling out is asking for a response. And that response isn't, oh, I liked your poem, or maybe break the line here instead of there. Like, you know what I mean? That response is you. And what do you add? What do you contribute to the thinking that went on in this poem? And I think I do think I learned that at a very young age from Emily Dickinson.
That's a lot. Breezy, you should go. I feel like I have to find something profound after Jericho.
Oh, I don't even mean to be profound. Not too much.
Well, it was. I love that. I love the idea of reading those dashes as spaces.
Yeah.
And what might be in the in-between. And that makes me think of how one might like introduce Dickinson to children as like as a teaching technique. I don't know though. I'm very much like encountering Dickinson's work like for real over the past year or so that we've been doing this show, because she was not a writer that I felt was writing for me, you know, and I didn't feel offended by that, but I also just didn't feel like, oh, let me go pick her up. It has been interesting as I've listened, as I've been, you know, reading these poems, and I've been feeling my way into them and feeling, you know, creating space for myself in them. You know, there are certain phrases of hers that I walk around saying randomly, you know, like hope is a thing with feathers, you know, and there's no way that that's not like influencing my work, but for now it's too soon to detangle.
It's always cast as like a a deficit. I don't mean that fully, but the idea, I didn't learn this earlier. I'm only getting to it now. But it's like, what would it be like for me to have encountered Dickinson for the first time, really, when I was way into poetry, like way into my own writing life already, like a little volcano in the middle of your, this is what was possible before. I don't know. Anyway,
yeah, I love coming to writers. They're like, I didn't read Morrison until I was about 25, and I'm kind of grateful. You know, other folks are reading her during high school, and I was like, I would not have, you know, I would have gotten a layer, you know, but I would not have like been over there freaking out like I was reading it by the time I knew what I was holding.
That's it. You're ready for it in a different way. Like Breezy, I feel like there are just Emily Dickinson lines that are in my head and have been since I was at least in college. I definitely remember. I'm sure I read her one or two poems in high school, but I studied a lot of Dickinson in college, and I still have the Final Harvest, the copy of Final Harvest with the pink highlighter over the numbers of the poems that I was assigned to read at that time. So I can know what my introduction to Dickinson was really like. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. I felt a funeral in my brain. They're just, these first lines are just there. I love the way that her language functions just so memorably that I, who can't memorize poems to save my life, I have maybe four poems memorized. And one of them is a Lucio Clifton poem that's like four lines. But Dickinson's lines, without me trying to memorize them, sort of just stick with me. The other part of it, to echo Jericho a little bit, is to say that there's a formal quality about her writing that really speaks to the formalist in me. I love an M-dash. Even my poems that are, you know, completely unlike Dickinson's will have the visual aesthetic, but I think also kind of a Dickinson Brooks double lineage, because Brooks was someone who was influenced by Dickinson. The rapture of a slant rhyme, I'm here for it, and I think I got that from Dickinson. She was just the way out of the you blue true new right sight white might rhyme scheme. You know, I want that off rhyme, slant rhyme kind of softer chime, and the meter that doesn't sound metered. That's what I love about Dickinson. It's completely metered and completely rhymed, but it doesn't announce itself.
Evie, thank you so much for coming on our show and giving us yet another beautiful episode. You're so wonderful. You're such a good poet. You're such a smart person. I am honored that you joined us. Thank you so much.
This was just a true pleasure. All three of you, you provide this context for thinking and feeling and then just sort of laughing, but also like digging into the serious stuff. It's marvelous, marvelous to spend time in your company.
Thanks for listening to The Slave Is Gone, where we continue the conversation started by Dickinson and go way beyond.
That's Breon Janae. Their first book is After Jubilee, and they're the author of Blessed Are the Peacemakers, which won the Caveh Canem Northwestern University Press Poetry Prize.
That's Jericho Brown. His book, The Tradition, won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. His other books include Please and The New Testament. Thanks to our special guest on this episode, Evie Shockley.
Watch for her new collection of poems, Suddenly We, which will be out in the new year. Our rogue scholar is Aoife Murray, author of Maid as Muse, How Servants Changed Emily Dickinson's Life and Language. Aoife and Lisa Rothman are the show's executive producers.
Matt Martin produces the show. Mary Ann Zahorsky and Celia Bolgatz engineer and edit our audio. Marissa Budlong and Anna Smith are our researchers. And our interns are Lola Anaya and Maggie Olszewski.
Dr. Marilyn Nelson and Dr. Terry Bonhorst Blackhawk are our advisors. And the show receives support from Mass Humanities and the Massachusetts Cultural Council.
Thanks to the many individuals who contributed to make this episode possible. You can give your support with a donation at theslaveisgone.com.
And a final thanks to Catherine Whitcomb and everyone at the Jones Library in Amherst, as well as to the Boutelle Day Poetry Center at Smith College.
We are on Twitter and Instagram. Follow us for bonus materials that take you deeper into Emily Dickinson's life and art and the world she lived in.
We'll give her the last word.
We lose because we win. Gamblers recollecting which toss their dice again.